Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket this morning that are going to be submitted with oral argument, and a few cases after that we will not hear oral argument in. So if counsel's ready in the first case, Ms. Spisak, would you please announce counsel?
Okay, please, the court. Mr. Stephen Wood will argue for appellant. Mr. David Ferris will argue for appellee.
Morning. My name is Steve Wood. I'm here representing the city of Crowley this morning. Appellee Mr. Doug Ray filed suit seeking damages against Tignall & Perkins, Inc., which is the city's engineer. The suit was filed for breach of contract, negligence, and breach of implied warranty. In addition, Mr. Ray also sought declaratory relief and the recovery of attorney's fees against the city under the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act. And I'll just refer to that as the Act to make that simple. Specifically, Mr. Ray made 9 requests for declaratory relief. They all sort of related to the city's floodplain maps, which described some real property that's owned by Mr. Ray and sought to be developed by Mr. Ray. Mr. Ray alleges in his petition that the city hired Tignall & Perkins to develop some criteria that went into the floodplain maps, that after construction of this property began, he learned that the information provided by the city engineer was incorrect, and that as a result of that, he was going to have to spend more money developing the property than he had previously anticipated. At the same time, the city filed its answer. The city filed a plea to the jurisdiction alleging that Mr. Ray had failed to invoke the jurisdiction of the trial court under the Act. The trial court denied the plea, and this appeal followed. We believe that the cases, specifically the Edwards Aquifer Authority case and the Pennington Associates case, one out of the Austin Court of Appeals, one out of the Houston Court of Appeals, establishes that in order to establish the trial court's jurisdiction under the Act, you have to allege an underlying cause of action or controversy that is within the scope of Section 37.004 of the Act.
And but that, how do you respond to Appley's argument that really the failure to state a cause of action is not a proper topic for a plea to the jurisdiction? That a plea to the jurisdiction asserting immunity is different from the failure to state a cause of action?
Well, the burden is on the plaintiff to show in his petition that immunity has been waived. And according to this case law, the way he does that is he pleads a controversy within the scope of the Act. If he has not done that, then immunity is not waived and the plea to the jurisdiction is appropriate.
Then what would be the purpose of special exceptions? How do you distinguish this situation from, is it just a unique situation that you don't need special exceptions when it's a governmental entity?
I don't remember the name of the case, but the Texas Supreme Court has established that it used to be the case maybe 15 years ago that you had to file special exceptions first if you had a failure of a pleading before you could file a plea of the jurisdiction. And now, under the Texas Supreme Court rule, you can file a plea to the jurisdiction as long as the plaintiff is allowed a reasonable opportunity to amend. So what we are contending here in this case, because it's sort of unique, we're not saying that the plaintiff failed to plead an element of a cause of action, for example, which could be remedied very easily at the trial court level. What we're saying is these requests are so specific that they did not invoke the jurisdiction of the court, and the only choice is for the court to say the court doesn't have jurisdiction under those requests, over those requests. Now, the plaintiff can always come back and allege something else, presumably within the scope of the Act, but what we are saying is these 9 requests did not invoke the jurisdiction of the court. And if you look at the language of Section 37.004, it says, a person interested under a deed, will, written contract, or other writing constituting a contract, or whose rights, status, or other legal relations are affected by a statute, municipal ordinance, contract, or franchise, may have determined any question of construction or validity arising under those instruments. Okay? And if you review the 9 requests for declaratory relief, nowhere is there mentioned a deed, a will, a contract, statute, or ordinance. They're not seeking to interpret the language of any city ordinance. They're not seeking to determine their rights under any ordinance. It is our contention that all of their requests for relief, which are related to these maps, are simply they're trying to get the court to establish questions of law, questions of fact, that will aid them in their prosecution of their causes of action against the city engineer. And the Texas Supreme Court has held in the BHP Petroleum case that that is an inappropriate use of the Declaratory Judgments Act. In other words, you can't have, let's say, if you allege a cause of action for trespass to try title, you can't then have a declaratory judgment request that says, we want the court to declare that they trespassed on my title, because that allows essentially the recovery of attorney's fees where there would not otherwise be the recovery of attorney's fees.
Is this or is this not analogous to Tort Claims Act, where you state something occurred but that you do not allege the use of motor-driven equipment or whatever the little exceptions are? Is this the same as that? You don't, and I assume in those cases you do not get a special exception chance to replead. You pled and you got it right or you didn't. But are these analogous or not?
I would think if it's just a pure pleading issue, and that I kind of analogize that to sort of missing the element of a cause of action. And I think that there is a distinction in this case because we're talking about requests for declaratory relief. And in other words, he can't go back and fix these 9 requests. He's going to have to make different requests. Whereas if you're just, you know, if you failed to plead that there was a city employee using motor-driven vehicle, you can always go back and fix that on amendment. But you can't do that with these 9 requests. In order for him to establish a jurisdiction of the court, he has to plead something that falls within the scope of Section 37004. The Boatman case, which is one of the cases that we are relying on, the Boatman v. Lights, it's a Tyler Court of Appeals case. They actually said that, if I can find it here, that it is improper to use render a declaratory judgment when there is no claim that a statute, ordinance, or deed is ambiguous or invalid. Okay, that language has been cited without question by the Austin Court of Appeals in the Ave Inc. versus Comal County case, and by this court in the Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist case. Both of those cases are cited in the reply brief, and both of those cases are memorandum opinions. But nonetheless, they were cited and applied in those cases. And so we believe under those authorities that the plaintiff simply has not done what the plaintiff needed to do to establish the jurisdiction under the Act. And unless there are any questions, I believe that's
where,
all I have.
What is the genesis of that, since that is not exactly following the language of the Declaratory Judgment Act that you were relying on? You were just talking about language, construing a will, construing a deed, construing a contract. I don't remember that it used the words ambiguous or where does that come from?
You are correct, and I think that's one of their first points in their response brief. That language is not contained in the Act, and actually there's a lot of case law that establishes rules that are not necessarily found in the language of the statute. For example, the rule that it's inappropriate to use the Declaratory Judgments Act to establish a cause of action already pending before the court. That's not in the statute. The way I interpret that language is the court is trying to say or try to come up with a rule to establish how a plaintiff can plead an underlying controversy within the scope of the act. And the plaintiff does that by alleging ambiguity or invalidity with one of those instruments.
In other words, they're saying in order to construe an ordinance, the way that one can have an ordinance that needs to be construed is it is ambiguous or...
Correct. The purpose, in my mind, of the act is so that parties can come and say, we have a problem with the language of a contract or an ordinance or a statute, and we want to know what it means and how it applies to our situation. What are our rights under that statute? We think there's ambiguity either in the language itself or in the application of that language to our circumstances. And so I think that's how the court is getting it, arrived at that conclusion. And in this case, again, we just don't have any allegation of any ambiguity or invalidity for any statute, contract, ordinance, or any, you know. And their argument is that the act should be interpreted liberally to apply to, you know, more than just those enumerated items, and we think that if the legislature intended that result, they would have put that language in the act.
They would have put other writings or something.
Correct.
Mr. Woods, you attach the statute to your appendix, and if you can flip to that with me in your brief, it says in the statute, a person interested under a deed, will, written contract, or other writings constituting a contract, or whose rights, status, or other legal relations are affected by a statute, municipal ordinance, or contract. I read that right. These nine items that have been listed on page 2 of your brief, aren't those writings?
They are not writings constituting a contract.
No, but they're writings that relate to a right, status, or other legal relations that are affected by the way in which the city of Crowley, through its ordinances, handles its building development plans, aren't they?
Well, you know, the city adopts these maps, and, you know, there's nothing in the record as to why, you know, what the purpose of that is, so I'm not sure I can elaborate on that. But I, when I read the language of the statute, I see, you know, written contract or other writings constituting a contract. And so the intent there is that it be a contract, and a map is not a contract.
Well, I would hope you'd read the next phrase also, because after the word constituting a contract, it says or whose rights, status, or other legal relations. I mean, that's an expansion and goes into the further clarifying by the second phrase of the language that's going before it, talking about other writings.
And the way I interpret that, and feel free to disagree, but the way I interpret that is, you're going to tell the trial court, we have a problem with the language of these things. Something is ambiguous about it, or we're having a problem with the way this language is being interpreted and applied to our situation.
Yes, sir.
And so the way I read that first part is, any person who's interested under a deed, will, written contract, or other writing constituting contract can have that language determined by a court, by declaratory judgment, or the application of that language to their situation because their rights status is affected by those instruments. And so, again, in this situation, we just don't see that we have a contract or that a contract deed statute is affecting their rights.
These nine items talking about the all of the revision, letter of revision maps and the other correspondence dealing with the flood zones affect how the building ordinances in the city of Crowley are applied to the rights of the persons that are involved with you in the litigation, don't they?
I mean, to the extent that developers, you know, they rely on those maps, I don't know. I mean, in our situation, we have property that's within a floodplain. I think that much is in the record. Our contention is if there was a flooding issue that they were having or an issue with drainage, they needed to have a study done, and I believe there was a study done, to ensure that those maps are correct. A map may be adopted by the city, and in this case, the map was over 15 years old. And so, you know, those maps need to be updated, and so I'm not sure. I think that in practice, the developer does not rely or should not rely on an old map to that extent, and has to, and those maps are constantly updated. So
let me quickly ask if I can distill your argument into two things. Argument number one, it is not a deed, will, written contract, et cetera, number one. Number two, even if we construe that it is, nothing has been alleged to be ambiguous or a problem with applying to us. That's the one and two step of your argument, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm going to reshuffle my argument to address the questions of Justice McCoy and Justice Meyer. Before I do that, though, I want to point out I've given you three new cases. We're not lying behind the log. We sort of tripped over it here at late night, but those are relevant cases. I was going to cite them. I knew you'd want a letter giving them to you, so there they are, and I want you to know I've given them to opposing counsel, highlighted just as they are before you. Okay, to address your questions, the counsel is right. The Boatman opinion, first of all, with the genesis of the Boatman opinion, it's a misreading of the Bell versus State Department of Highways and Public Transportation, as I pointed out in on page 7 of the appellant's brief, excuse me, of the appellee's brief. And it came up with this beautiful boilerplate that says you got to, you know, allege somehow that a contract or a statute or an ordinance is vague or invalid. And that's boilerplate that's in the two other cases he cites, the Ave case and the Mount Calvary case out of this court, and other cases as well. But it's boilerplate and it's dicta in every case that I've read. And it's usually in a case, as it is in all three of Boatman, Mount Calvary, and Ave, it's dicta because the real issue in those cases is, counsel, you've tried to shoehorn in an attorney's fees claim in a case you wouldn't otherwise be entitled to one, and we're not going to allow that. So it's just one of those things that gremlins stick in opinions. I can speak firsthand to that. But the language in Boatman, Mount Calvary, Ave, all the other cases are trumped by what the Texas Supreme Court case, Supreme Court said in the second opinion I gave you there, and that is the Bonham State Bank case. The Bonham State Bank case involved the question of offsetting two opposing judgments. Bank had a judgment against the debtor. The debtor had a judgment for wrongful garnishment against the bank. Bank's concerned, you know, they're ahead of us, and if we pay them off this money for wrongfully garnishing a bank account, well, not only may we never collect our judgment, but we'll also even be out more money. And Justice Owen, speaking for the Supreme Court, said, you know, this is a perfect case for a declaratory judgment action. And she addressed this very issue. And she addressed the two statutes that are appended to the appellee's brief, and that is 37002, that says the act is remedial and to be liberally construed. And the second one, 37003, says that you ignore those enumerations in 37004, which is cited by the city of Crowley. The statute means what it says, that they are not exclusive and do not restrict the application of the act. That, I think, is the short answer to that. Now, there is also another case. The first case I gave you is the State versus Morales. And here, that I could have given you 50 different cases. That's just a very recent Supreme Court opinion that has said something we've all heard over and over again, and that is that the Declaratory Judgment Act is merely a procedural device for deciding cases already within a court's jurisdiction. The act neither giveth jurisdiction nor does it taketh jurisdiction away. It doesn't say, well, in these cases that you could have heard in some other form, you suddenly have less jurisdiction because they don't involve a contract or a statute or an ordinance that somebody claims is vague or illegal. So that applies not only to the substantive issue before the court, that also is applicable, I think, to the to our concern that the court lacks jurisdiction to hear this interlocutory appeal. There is another line of cases that the city of Crowley cites. That's the
This language literally, mm-hmm. I'm going back to your first case about does not limit or restrict the exercise of general powers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We could take that to say that if somebody came over and painted my house, I could ask for a declaratory judgment that it was done improperly.
You could, Your Honor, and the Supreme Court would pour you out, and here's why. Somebody's done that already, and I don't cite the case. I know it's out there, though, where it's like in a car wreck case. It was some sort of a negligence case, and then maybe it's been done 50 times again. I don't know. But the idea was, hey, I can shoehorn in attorney's fees by asking the court to declare that the defendant's negligence caused my whiplash and or whatever. Or, you know, cause my house to be improperly painted.
And declare that somebody breached a contract.
I think, and I don't know how to define the difference there, but I think it's probably close to this. If you can find it in the pattern jury charges, then you're not entitled to seek your remedy in a declaratory judgment act. I'm not real comfortable with that either. But that's not the issue before the court today. And I thought about that. I thought, should I brief that? I'm just too lazy, Your Honor, until I have to, because it definitely isn't an issue today. Finally, there's one third case that is before you today that I cited, and it's a case out of this court as well. It's the City of Argyle case, and it's a recent opinion. It's a 2008 opinion. Justice McCoy, you wrote that opinion. And in it, the court points out that the declaratory judgment action was a proper way to determine whether or not the plaintiff's conduct violated a sign ordinance. Didn't involve, and as you pointed out in the opinion, the validity of this ordinance was never at issue. In fact, the matter is the plaintiffs assumed that the ordinance was valid in their approach and in an argument of the case. And I think that makes the point, again, that the Declaratory Judgment Act, as Justice Owen said in the Bonham State Bank case, is a much broader and more liberally applied remedy than just the enumerated suggestions of 37.004. And I will yield the rest of my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris.
I apologize. I was none of these cases obviously were briefed, and I was just handed them, so I have not had a chance to review.
I assume you want to provide us something in a reasonable period of time addressing those cases.
I would appreciate that opportunity. Yes.
What do you consider to be a reasonable amount of time?
3 days.
And 3 days is fine, and there's no need to file a brief. You can file a letter brief.
Okay.
Mr. Ferris, if you deem there's anything you need to do a sir reply to, you can have 3 days to reply to his letter.
And so the only really point I guess I wanted to respond to briefly was the point that the holding in the Boatman v. Lights case was dicta. I do disagree with that conclusion. In the Boatman case, the plaintiff brought a trespass to try title case and a cause of action under Chapter 11 of the Water Code, and then sought to have the court declare that the defendants had trespassed on their title and had violated the Water Code. And the court basically said that that was an inappropriate use of the act. And so, in other words, since the plaintiff did not allege an ambiguity in the Water Code, there was no jurisdiction over that case, over those requests. And so I do believe that that it's not dicta, that the Boatman rule is not dicta. And again, if you would look at the Ov, Inc. Versus Comal County case and the Missionary Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church cases, from this court, both applying that language, I think you'll see that it was not dicta in those cases as well. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Your case is submitted. We appreciate you appearing here today, and we appreciate your arguments. And we will, you all are dismissed, and we will allow counsel for the next case to move forward. And Mr. O-